On this edition of the program, Donald Trump's professional victimization and whether or not it's going to make a difference at the ballot box in November. And Corey Nathan joins the program. We talk about religion and politics for 30 minutes. Do we kill each other? Only one way to find out. It's all coming up.
This is made possible by Oh Them Bones, Daily Tech News Show, V, and Craig.
Welcome, everybody, to the Politics, Politics, Politics program for February 17th, 2024. Your old pal, Justin Robert Young, joining you from Austin, Texas. Let's get into things here. I want to read you from Politico.com, Kyle Cheney reporting. Donald Trump is learning a hard lesson. Criminal defendants don't get to set their own schedules. Three times on Monday, the former president asked Justin Juan Merchan to cut him loose from his hush money trial to attend other matters, some personal, some political, and some legal. Three times, the judge responded with essentially, we'll see. Could he attend his son Barron's high school graduation on May 17th? I'll get back to you, Merchan said. May he skip the trial on April 25th to attend Supreme Court arguments about whether he's immune from special counsel Jack Smith's charges for trying to subvert the 2020 election. Not likely, said Merchan. And can he be exempted from any proceedings that may arise on Wednesdays when Merchan's court is typically dark so he can campaign? Not if the jury is in, the judge told him. And on the article goes, describing that Donald Trump is indeed reaping what he sowed. But is that the case? Now, before I go any further, please be advised. We're about to enter into a strange realm where no one really knows up from down. The world of Trump strategy. Is he a 5D chess master or a Jar Jar Binks level buffoon? Who sometimes happens to benefit from wild luck. So, knowing that proof in these matters are hard to agree on, let me make this case. Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States, looking to be the 47th, wants to make his son Barron's graduation very famous. He wants every campaign event he can't attend, even if he was never going to attend them to begin with, to be very famous. He wants pictures of sad teenagers in caps and gowns. He wants supporters waiting in the rain for him. He wants to prove that this and every trial after it is indeed election interference to the letter. And to do that, he needs to appear, interfered with. The Trump campaign believes that positioning him as a victim of a weaponized system is very, very effective. Humanizes somebody who's, let's just say, got a bit of a reputation for being a bit of an a-hole. It paints Democrats, the media, and yes, very specifically, the courts as being out of step with the average citizen. And possibly, most importantly, in this case, considered the flimsiest of the four brought against him, it inoculates him against forthcoming legal action. How do I know? Well, because it's already worked once in the last year. Let's go back in time. As we entered last spring, Donald Trump wasn't the runaway presumptive nominee. He was girding for a fight with one-time protege Ron DeSantis. And on March 30th, the Florida governor was 15% behind Trump, according to the Real Clear Politics average. As fate now tells us, it was the closest that he would ever be. On April 4th, Coincidentally, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg announced the charges that we are seeing go to court now. By the end of the month, Trump was up nearly 30% on DeSantis. Three more indictments came in by the end of August, and by the end of that month, Trump's up 40 on his nearest competitor. After being arraigned on all those charges and mugshotted for one of them, he clears 50% over his nearest competitor by the beginning of 2024. I know what you're saying. That's only the Republican nomination. This election in November will be decided by general election voters choosing between Trump and Biden. Well, let's look at that race then. Aside from a four-day hiccup in February, the very first time that Trump opened up any kind of sustained lead against Joe Biden in the Real Clear Politics average came, you guessed it, in April, after the New York indictments. Since then, Biden has only led by a point or less for 1 month between July and September. Trump has led by as much as 3.5. That was this January. But if you look at that RCP average now, Trump's lead has shrunk, which some might say is a perfect time to play the hits. And for Trump 2024, that is, radical Soros DAs are destroying this country, not only by refusing to prosecute crime, but also engaging in blatant election interference against your favorite president. Here are the last four text message alerts that I've received from the Trump fundraising team in the last 72 hours. Quote, in 48 hours, America will cease to exist. Here's the next one. I'm in court now. They're trying to destroy me, but you can stop them. Here's number three. My trial just started, and the coup de grace yesterday, I just stormed out of court. They think I'm finished, but I'll never surrender. Now, fundraising texts are fundraising texts. They are designed to be hyperbolic. My point in bringing those up is to say Donald Trump is not minimizing this stuff. He's maximizing it. And that means that he and his team believe it is a strength. And unlike many of Trump's whims, there seems to be a statistical argument to back this one up. And beyond that, there is a bit of brilliance in making Barron's high school graduation a political football. Age is an issue in this election. Don't know if you've noticed it. And while both of the candidates are not too far from each other on either side of 80, the last time that Joe Biden had to worry about a high school graduation for one of his kids was 1998. It was before I graduated high school, and I have gray hair. Is Trump whining and making a big deal about this? Yes. Is it joyful for his enemies to scream "cry harder" at their televisions? Of course. But what if both of those things, both of them together, make Trump a more sympathetic figure, a very defined person getting a new definition? Well, if that were the case, he'd be happy to cancel plans every day so the world media could watch him be slowly martyred by the deep state. And he'll be sure to let you know about each and every canceled plan on his calendar. This is your update brought to you by TakePoliticsSeriously.com. If you want bonus episodes of this show, no matter how you get it, by the way, you listen via podcast, you watch via YouTube, the only place that you can get bonus episodes that appear on both video and audio is TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Head on over there. Get two bonus episodes each and every week. Again, in both forms, audio, video. Any way you want it, that's the way you need it. It's our motto here at PX3. TakePoliticsSeriously.com, $3 level, gets you those two bonus episodes that cover all the news that we miss on our free podcasting schedule. So if you wanted a heaping helping of commentary on the security state in Iran and Israel, well, the episode we put out on Monday is what you want. We reviewed all of the Sunday shows as we do each and every week, and Lord knows what we're going to be covering on tomorrow's episode, the late edition on Thursday. But first, here are some stories we didn't get a chance to talk about in our show today. An intense political standoff with House GOP Representatives Thomas Massie has announced his support for Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's effort to oust Speaker Mike Johnson. Oh, baby. Trump tried to settle the waters. He said, MAGA Mike, follow him. Then FISA happens, and now Johnson says, okay, we're not going to vote on one big aid bill. We're going to split it up into four aid bills, and it's going to be Ukraine in one, Israel in another, Taiwan in another, and then a fourth grab bag that will be the TikTok bill plus the convert this foreign aid to loans. And then, I don't know, a potpourri, a dealer's choice, apparently. And then of those that get passed, they are going to combine those into one bill and send that back to the Senate. A little complicated. And by the way, it's going to bleed into the weekend, which never makes the House members particularly happy. And so, even though Donald Trump has tried to stop some of the angrier members of his MAGA caucus from chucking Johnson to the curb, not so much. Massie, in backing Green, marks the first Republican endorsement of that motion, putting Johnson in a precarious position where he may require Democratic votes to maintain his speakership. Spoiler alert, almost assuredly going to happen. The opposition strategy to Johnson includes a potential forced vote on Johnson's speakership, as Massie suggests that Johnson should preemptively resign before that vote. That would be a move reminiscent of Speaker John Boehner's exit, where they were able to go without an interregnum that had no speaker because Boehner would resign after the new speaker was chosen, and so you could keep the business of the House moving. Which is a very delightful request from Massie. I'm going to kill you, but I would prefer it if you committed suicide so I didn't get charged for murder. I want all of the results, and I want zero of the consequences. Meanwhile, Democrats have remained noncommittal in supporting Johnson's proposals, waiting to assess the details of the packages, which have yet to be released. The situation is further complicated by former President Donald Trump's advocacy for the loan-based aid to Ukraine, influencing some Republican stance. With Johnson's plan pending in the House and an uncertain fate in the Senate, the political dynamics hint at turbulent times ahead for the leaders and their legislative agendas. So just to catch you up on all this, Mike Johnson is fighting for a speakership. He is looking to get this FISA bill through. The big amendment, he eventually allows a vote on the amendment that would essentially do what many wanted, which is to force the intelligence community to get a warrant if they ever want to even incidentally collect data or surveil American citizens in America. FISA 702 allows you to, without a warrant, spy on foreign nationals outside of the country without a warrant. But sometimes Americans get caught up. So it was the get a warrant crew, and it came very close. Oh boy, did it come very close. It came the closest. A tied vote in the House. So someone's got to pass the tie-breaking vote. He was already on the record of saying he was going to do it. Boom. Mike Johnson, make sure that the amendment fails. FISA passes. That rattles the cage to folks like Representative Massie. And now Johnson's trying to make good by saying, I'm not going to force my Republican caucus to vote on a big stapled together bill with Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan. Some people want some of it. Some people want others. So let's all vote on each part of it, and then we'll repackage it together, send it on over to the Senate. Little too little, little too late. And the numbers on what is being asked are pretty big. In fact, the Ukraine package, I believe, would be the largest Ukraine package that we have sent them. Although at this point, the handwriting's on the wall that it's probably going to be the last. National Public Radio has suspended Uri Berliner, a senior editor with over two decades of experience at that outlet, following his public critique of the organization's left-leaning bias. Berliner's suspension, which was for 5 days without pay, was reported by NPR's own media reporter, David Fulkenflik. Oh, come on, we just making these names up. The NPR media reporter is named Fulkenflik. This isn't a Mighty Wind character. All right, moving on. The controversy arose after Berliner published an essay in the Free Press claiming NPR's coverage reflects a very narrow viewpoint not representative of the broader U.S. populace. This action by NPR has ignited further criticism from those who have long accused the broadcaster of a liberal bias, providing them with additional ammunition. The situation has escalated as critics brought to light social media posts by NPR CEO Catherine Marr, which includes praise for Democrats, including one of her wearing a Biden reelection hat, critical remarks about former President Donald Trump. In response to Berliner's essay and the subsequent fallout, Marr defended the integrity of NPR's journalism in a note to staff. Meanwhile, Berliner, in his discourse with Fulkenflik, emphasized the need for leadership that unifies the broader perspectives within NPR. The issue has even caught the attention of Trump, who echoed the calls for defunding NPR, criticizing its leadership and their handling of the situation, as well as their responses to Berliner's assertions. So if you've not been following this, and I know you guys love it when, you know, the former journalist gets to make things about what they really should be about, journalism. The Free Press is an outlet that's run by Barry Weiss. Barry Weiss is a former New York Times person who has set a template. She left the New York Times and talked very, very publicly about it. And so she has now created a home for people that are upset with how leftward tilting journalistic outlets that at least at some point aspired to a higher calling than advocacy, at least by their perspective, to come and tell their story. I like the joke that every headline for these kinds of stories could essentially be, "We might have liberaled too hard," says liberal. But that is Barry Weiss's brand. She has done very well with it on Substack, and they have done some really, really good stuff at the Free Press. I think it's well worth reading. This article was interesting. The Uri Berliner one that got him in trouble. It pointed out that when he surveyed 87 people that worked in the editorial department at the Washington, D.C. Bureau of NPR, the largest that they have, he found 87 Democrats and zero Republicans. Not even a Chris Sununu fan, right? We don't have any Larry Hogan Knights? No Hogan Maniacs? Huh? Not even the Never Trumpers? Can I get a Mitt Romney fan in the house? Nothing? Wow. Okay. NPR being liberal is nothing new, although Berliner does point out demographic stats that it has courted an audience that now is far more progressive than it used to be. And I buy that, because whether or not conservatives always believed that NPR was fair, NPR, you know, has a certain aesthetic. They play classical music and they have this American life, and Diane Rehm talks to people. It's, you know, a kind of as you age and tend to become a little bit more conservative demographically, sometimes you want stuff that's a little less shock jockey, loud and explosive. NPR brings you that to this day. The only difference is that now it's a lot more conversation about affinity groups than something that even with a leftward tilt would be looked at closely resembling the middle, at least according to Berliner. But let me make this point. I don't think Berliner wrote that for the Free Press unless he was ready to be punished and likely leave NPR. I do believe that if you are running an organization and someone goes out of pocket and writes about how your organization sucks for another organization, that you do need to close ranks and probably excise that person. I think I've been consistent on this. When you have the Biden administration youngsters coming out and saying, well, they're not doing what we want them to do, I have said on this show before, find the youngest staffer and fire them. And say, we are going to keep firing people until you narc on who went and talked to the press about this. Because you need to close ranks. That's a political campaign. Obviously, there's a lot of high stakes. Even in a media institution, you got to be rooting for the flag a little bit. You got to be rooting for your teammates. You got to be rooting for the banner. So I don't blame them for suspending it. Indeed, I would expect that he will eventually leave. And I will take a wild guess that he might end up at the Free Press. Finally, the Department of Justice is preparing to file an antitrust lawsuit against Live Nation, a major player, if not the major player, in ticketing and live events, amid allegations of market dominance abuse. This legal action follows intense scrutiny from lawmakers and consumer advocacy groups after a highly publicized mishap during the ticket sales for Taylor Swift's Eras Tour in 2022, which underscored Live Nation's significant market control. The DOJ's interest in Live Nation isn't new. The agency has been monitoring the company since its merger with Ticketmaster in 2010, which led to a consent decree intended to curb its market influence. The decree was extended in 2020, enhancing DOJ's oversight capabilities. The potential lawsuit, which could be filed as early as next month, according to the Wall Street Journal, aims to not dismantle Live Nation, but to address specific anti-competitive practices. Live Nation has defended itself by stating the ticket prices are set by artists and event teams, not by the company itself. However, this lawsuit aligns with a broader trend under the Biden administration of DOJ targeting major corporations for antitrust, including Apple and Google. And in an election year, no less, I'll be. Somebody pointed out the other day that, you know, the 90s are really back. The 90s are back. No Doubts touring. Will Smith was on stage with the headliner of Coachella in the Men in Black suit, rapping the Men in Black song. Conan O'Brien has never been more popular. Salman Rushdie is doing a press round. And now, Ticketmaster under fire. Where have you gone, Eddie Vedder? A nation turns its lonely eye to you. That'll be your update. TakePoliticsSeriously.com is where you need to go. Head on over there right now to support us. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus episodes each and every week. Video, audio, both at the same damn time. Now our interview. Friends, I don't know if you've noticed, but this year specifically, with an election dawning and everything that's happening internationally, it seems that the two subjects are literally impossible to talk about, politics and religion. And so our guest has dared to do the impossible twice. He is the host of the Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other podcast. He is Corey Nathan. Welcome to the show, Corey.
Justin, it's great to be with you, man. Thanks for having me on.
Why bring us to the intersection of religion and politics? Obviously, it is historically the two things that you don't talk about. We have mainstreamed politics in a way that is great for shows like mine because more people care about the subject matter, possibly terrible for society. And religion has always been a hot button issue that now has been mainstreamed in the same kind of way because of international events. Why are you fascinated by this intersection? Or is it just masochism?
A little of both, actually. My main MO is that I realize that so many people who take all the oxygen out of the room on these subjects are exactly the wrong people that we want to lead the conversation. What I think of as extremists and screamers. And I realize in having these conversations that so many more people are not the extreme. So many more people have more nuanced views. And yet we're sort of crowded out of the space by the loudest, most obnoxious folks who just want to assert whatever talking points they've memorized from whatever, you know, conflict entrepreneur that they're memorizing and regurgitating. So I say, am I allowed to curse on the show, by the way?
You can. We will edit it out, but okay. you can if you'd like.
All right. So I won't say, you know, what I was going to say, but I say to hell with that. Literally, yeah. To hell with that. You know, so these subjects are so important. It's really two of the main subjects that we talk about in terms of how we live well among each other. And if they're hijacked by folks who have other ends in mind, whether it's dominating a conversation or dominating a land or all kinds of other ends, that's they're hijacking these subjects from other people that might come in goodwill and good faith. And most of us are just what David French would refer to as the exhausted majority. We're just exhausted. Yeah. We just don't want to deal with it. But I don't want to opt out. I don't want to cede that ground to those extremists and those screamers. So that's why I've endeavored to embark on this masochistic journey.
You have embraced debate when it comes to the debate itself, which is very interesting. Ooh. You know, one of the things that I find fascinating in that realm is that it's not that people have a loud opinion. Because people have had loud opinions forever. We've always had demagogues in entertainment and people that have taken various different positions. What is interesting in a post-internet world where the conversation itself, the comment section is now the show. We have a less of a focus on, okay, we're all going to watch a thing and then we're going to discuss it. Now the discussion itself is its own a circus, is that you tend to, I know I've had this reaction to just say, well, all right, this conversation is too hot. I'm just going to sort of make my way around it. Even if behind the scenes, you do talk to people and you're like, wow, this person, a friend of ours, is now super into, you know, a certain position on Twitter. They're going on and on and on about it. Everybody knows that it's, if not embarrassing, at least very extra, but nobody really wants to say anything because you just kind of assume, okay, well, that's just a thing that's happening right now. How do you decide when to engage and when to not engage?
It's an important set of qualifications that it's worth thinking about. So you mentioned comment sections.
Yeah,
I often avoid comment sections like the plague, man, to be honest with you, because part of what you'll find is that even on some stuff that are on our platforms, I realize that some of the folks that are piping in and have the strongest point of view haven't even read the article, haven't even listened to the interview. You know, they read the headline and they have really strong points of view about the headline, but they're just talking out of their, you know, their orifice, if you will, for polite company. So I will get into the conversations. I try to get into conversations with people that I already have an established relationship with, because then we have a human context. We know each other as human beings, as opposed to one data point or one comment. And then based on that one comment or data point, I go and construct an entire narrative about this entire person, their entire life story. That's a terrible way to engage. The other thing that I try to do is I'm not good at this. I'm practicing this. I'm trying to get better at it. But I try to adapt a posture of, if for lack of a better word, leaving the room for the possibility that I'll arrive at a point where I might say, huh, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
If I'm talking to somebody that has a different point of view from me, I want to lead with radical curiosity, as Monty Guzman from Brave Rangels might say.
Yeah.
Whereas if I catch myself falling, I have a proclivity to be competitive, to like fall into that contentious disposition and want to debate somebody and show them. And I do it all the time, and it's the wrong way. The right way is that curious disposition of, tell me about that. Oh, that's interesting. Wait, how did you arrive at that conclusion? Tell me more about your life. I'm curious about, you know, at what point you came to that conclusion, you know, and then all of a sudden now we have a connection. I'm learning about a human being, you know, I'm learning about their story. And that's a much more fertile ground to have a better conversation about tough issues like this.
I'm a huge internet optimist. I have my career because of the internet. I, from a very young age growing up in journalism, believed in the power of the internet. But the one thing that I do feel we want from the internet that is absolutely not true is that it is in any way a simulation of face-to-face human dialogue. Now, it can be rewarding. It can be enriching. You can find people that you would have otherwise not found. You can form relationships and friendships, but it is a reality or a reality distorting position. And so when you're talking about stuff like that, I very much believe that that's great to have. And Braver Angels is a great example where parameters are set. You have a very clever way to announce your position and then have a conversation on top of it. But, you know, sometimes I'll have friends of mine, especially post 2016, when everything sort of went haywire. There was definitely a cracking of the crystal and ghosts and spirits flew out of it. And we are still sort of dealing with that in a third act of Ghostbusters kind of way. But the solution became, okay, well, I'm going to wade into comment sections of places that I don't agree with, or I'm going to interact with people on Twitter more than I would otherwise because removing myself was a bad idea. To which I thought then, and I think now, no, that's a bad idea. You don't want to go into places where, you know, if you don't want to get stabbed, then don't walk into the knife factory that, you know, everybody is going crazy in. And that's often what these places are. Where do you find on the internet specifically to be healthy places to have these kinds of conversations, if anywhere?
I do think there are places. I think that if we're consciously curating our own feeds and establishing a set of rules on our own platforms, I think that's a good start. You know, I can't change the world. I can change, you know, I could change what I do, how I react, my little corner. I can't even really change my own little corner of the world, but I can try to have a little bit of an impact on it. So starting with a clear set of rules, like, you know, silliness will be ignored. Lies will be checked. Violence will be reported. You know, that's everybody who chimes in on any of my feeds knows mm-hmm. that's a general set of guidelines. I do think there are places I've found, you know, for lack of a better word, I've found that gated communities online are often a good place. Listen, you know, not everybody is in a position where they can pay the subscription for a Dispatch or a Bulwark, but Dispatch in particular, or certain folks, I found some Substacks. But, you know, for me, paying $5 a month, essentially what I'd pay for a cup of coffee or two.
Yeah.
I'm more of a Wawa and 7-Eleven kind of cup of coffee guy. But even still, like, you know, a couple of cups of coffee, I can, you know, I can get a subscribe. I can subscribe and support a writer, a thinker that I really believe in. Elliot Kirshner, for example, mm-hmm. who was, you know, who's a very thoughtful guy. He's a background in broadcast journalism. And he just established his own Substack and writing his own stuff. Man, I love the conversations on that platform. Dispatch too. You know, they're paying, I think that one's closer to $10 a month or plus or minus. But still, it's worth it. It's worth it to have thoughtful, good journalism, a commitment to good principles of excellent journalism. But then when you get to those comment sections, they're really engaging with the material. They actually read the entire article and are commenting from an informed point of view. It doesn't mean everybody agrees, but at least we're starting with a common set of content, you know?
Yeah.
So I do think there are some places, but you know, you have to, we all have to be, at the end of the day, we all have to be responsible citizens. And part of that is being more educated, more thoughtful about where we're engaging and how we're engaging. So I think it's an important question to explore.
A common set of facts is something that I think is probably at the root of, if I were to define a solution, or at least the absence of a common set of facts is the almost universally the reason why things get so frustrating. And there is no more issue or no greater issue in that specific realm in our modern era, at least for me, than if we might seg a little bit into the international relations flavored part of the religion element of this, what is happening in the Middle East right now, which I've found really, really, really frustrating to engage in dialogue, not only on the online, but also in some of my personal relationships, largely because I come to that from an American perspective and from a curiosity perspective. It's just somebody who, you know, when I was in college was up 2 o'clock in the morning working at the newspaper, and I'd be looking at Drudge Report siren gifs because the Intifada was happening. And so I just followed this story for several decades. Doesn't make me an expert. It makes me a guy who read a lot of newspaper articles. And it's very interesting now that it's become extraordinarily front and center now, that when the most passionate among us start talking about it, it's very often on a very defined set of facts from their perspective. And I found it hard to even break in to say, well, wait a minute. Can we just pull back a little bit and see where we even agree on the basics of this? Do you have any thoughts on peeling the layers back on stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a really good issue. If we can figure that one out, at the very least, how to talk to each other better on that one.
Yeah.
Because listen, I have family in Israel. So mm-hmm. I literally just got an email from the eldest, one of the elders there, my cousin Sheila, who's about 80, just saying, okay, the grandkids are all safe. They're all accounted for. We did lose my cousin's nephew on October 7th. So it's something wow. that is very close to home. But I have a very, very dear friend. We collaborate on her podcast. She has a great show. And she tends to be on the other side of this issue, but she's not a pro Hamas, pro Hezbollah.
Yeah.
She is pro Palestinian civilian. Mm-hmm. She's pro civilian in Gaza. She's anti genocide. And she's very specific with the way that she would define genocide. And I know that's where she's coming from. Right. I knew that on October 7th, because we had talked about the history of Israel and Palestine, and we explored our differences. You know what she did? I'm going to get emotional talking about this, man. But like we were on a conversation the week after that happened. And of all as passionate a differences as we have on the issue, and as much as I literally identify, my family is there, as much as she identifies with the civilians. Mm-hmm. who are being slaughtered there on the Gaza side. You know what her first question to me was? How you doing, brother?
Oh, yeah.
She just wanted to check in.
Yeah.
You know, she wanted to see how I was doing. That's a good place to start.
Yes.
That's a good place to start.
Humanity. I didn't
mean to get emotional, but like, yeah, just like we're human beings and we care. And I have some funnier stories that kind of all lead to the same place. Like there was a story on CBS.
I mean, that's a pretty low bar for comedy. So anywhere we go north from there, I think we're going to be good.
Yeah. So there was a story on CBS Sunday Morning that showed a similar dynamic. But one of my cousins is a civil engineer mm-hmm. and they were building the infrastructure for a new development, like a new housing project. And a neighbor who was going to be a part of the new housing project, Palestinian Muslim, also a civil engineer. And they had to, together, they had to collaborate on the sewage system. So, and then they ultimately became friends,
yeah.
You know, and she said, you know what? We became friends because we had to figure out our crap. Literally.
Literally.
We had to literally figure out our crap.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, there is a way to do this, but I think part of it is it just starts with how you doing, brother, you know, and I'll sit in on a conversation with a Palestinian scholar from Bethlehem. You know, I've listened to scholars and faith leaders that are Palestinian, you know, who identify, who are Muslim, Bedouin, Christian, Palestinian Christians. I have a much better understanding from their point of view, but we start with a common thread of each other's humanity, right?
Yeah, and that's what's really I have found challenging is that, again, on this subject, I know enough to be dangerous. I spent 1 week in Israel and I talked to Palestinians while I was there, or people from the territories when I was there. But I am, again, by no means a studied expert, let alone one in terms of the underlying religious causes for which has, informed a lot of this. That being said, when I come into conversations that are very cut and dry, Israel does this. The only thing that I wish is for folks who have that perspective, please go have a conversation with five Israelis. Not because they're going to convince you one way or another, but you're going to find out very, very fast that they probably don't agree on much of anything. And so to lump in the entire state of Israel when every Israeli I've ever known has been very pointed opinions that are in no way universal is interesting to me, especially because that region is so fascinating. It is obviously rich with history. It's rich with religious history. It's rich with ethnic history. And to not look at it in the complexity, especially in a moment of crisis like we find ourselves now, I think just leaves everybody poorer by the end of it, because it is to use a biblical term, a Gordian knot, or not a biblical term, but a historical term, a Gordian knot of problems. If you really care about it, we should spend the time to understand it. And that's what I think, especially when we get into these thorny issues, it just becomes a retreat to the bumper stickers, which really only exercises people's, fingers and vocal cords at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Malice makes strange bedfellows sometimes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
This last weekend, I thought it was notable that there were what I think of as campus protesters at one of the Trump rallies in Pennsylvania. The campus protesters shouting, Genocide Joe, Genocide Joe. And here's the thing, a lot of what I've observed and a lot of good work has been done on this, the breakdown of liberalism, not, like liberal progressive, Democratic Party, but like classic liberalism, the breakdown or the lack of understanding of the freedoms that were articulated in the First Amendment, the freedom of speech, the freedom of assembly. And I believe in these as high virtues, right? The freedom to petition our government. I believe in all of those. The freedom of religion, the freedom from religion as well. But those values have not been demonstrated in a lot of the protests that we've seen over these last 6-7 months. And yet these campus protesters are the ones who went to the Trump. Like, malice makes strange bedfellows, man.
Boy, when you have, Rashida Tlaib and Candace Owens on one side and John Fetterman and Ben Shapiro on another, things we have shaken up the divisions, and there is a lot of conversation from one side or the other. Let me ask you about this, and this is more on the religion side. You have a very interesting path. You converted from Judaism to Christianity. We are in America, a country that has turned less and less to faith over the last several decades. I think I saw something on Twitter, so take it all with a grain of salt, that while the common understanding is that 1 in 5 citizens in America now attend church regularly, that there was cell phone data to suggest that it's probably far lower. It's more like 1 in 22 or something like that. Do you think that there is something, as somebody who's thought a lot about religion from your perspective, that there is something lost by organized religion becoming less and less popular?
I do, actually. I do, because there is something of eternal value. There's something that I think is longing in us. What C.S. Lewis, I think that was the scholar, who would refer to as the God-shaped void. I had a great conversation with a lady named Kate Cohen last week She's a brilliant writer, beautiful writer, actually. Just I love her work. But she's not only is she an atheist, she wrote this book that came out last year about how she's consciously raising her kids as atheists. Mm-hmm. And these are some of the things that we talked about. We talked about, well, what are some of those things that a lot of the reason that she's an atheist is it's kind of like it's a switch that never got turned on for her. The idea that there's this transcendent being outside of time, outside of space. It's just not something that computes for somebody like Kate. And I get that. The way I think of it as I've thought of, is this a closed universe within which only the natural, you know, order of things can happen? Or is it an open universe, a universe that there's something beyond the physical world that we can observe? I've obviously come to the conclusion that it's an open universe. You know, but the things that I talked about with Kate had to do, and I've had conversations with good friends. John Rausch is an atheist, brilliant dude. And we've talked about this, like what's missing? And the sense of transcendence, the sense of being a part of a story that started way before my birth and is going to continue way after my death, and plugging into who I am as a person within the context of a larger people. So next Monday, when I gather together with my family and observe the Seder, which is the order of dinner, retelling the Exodus story as Jews, because I'm still Jewish. I'm a Christian. I believe in the risen Jesus. I believe, you know, I'm a Bible thumper. I'm a Christian, you know, all that stuff, but I'm still Jewish. So when I gather together, my father will be there. Both my kids, my sons will be there. My oldest kid is up north that, and they won't be able to make it down, but I'm participating in a story, a retelling of a story that we tell in the first person plural. This is what God did for us when he brought us out of the land of Egypt, you know, that when he freed us as slaves. So that's something that I think is missing, you know, whether it's Jewish, Christian, or other traditions. There is something that allows us here. And here's what it comes down to. I think if we can allow ourselves to understand the uniqueness of our individuality within the context of a people, that to me is the right balance. And I don't know. I think religion properly understood and practiced in a healthy way as humans who in the Judeo-Christian tradition love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, all the dimensions that make us uniquely human. I think that's additive, man. I think that's good.
I have obviously more thoughts on this that are going to fit into our tiny little interview space here, but I think our retreat as Americans from religion or organized religion, let's say, is in my mind, broadly speaking, a byproduct of explosive American progress, something that we have both been and everybody listening has been a beneficiary of, that we have become richer. We've become more technologically advanced. We've been able to live longer. We can communicate like we are right now. And I can make a living doing, talking into my silly little can here. These are extraordinarily exciting things. And culturally, we have also evolved as well. And that has brought us away from staples that were there to hold society together. But I totally agree with you that I do think that whether or not folks find organized religion, and you know, I was raised in a very, very, very liberal Methodist church in South Florida. I've always joked that you could go from that faith to atheist in a long nap. And indeed, one day I did. It's never been anything that I have not found any kind of quarrel with organized religion. And in fact, I don't really ever refer to myself as atheist, largely because I find self-described atheists to be so annoying that I would never want to align myself with them. God bless them all. But
so to speak,
but I do think that meaning is something that we struggle for. And that in the D&D character sheet of our culture, we have slid forward a lot of really great things that I think will advance society and civilization if not for centuries, possibly make us a multi-planet species that is fantastic for all of us and our kids and kids and kids going forward. But meaning is something that we have sacrificed. Connection is something that we have sacrificed to do that and to make changes to our society. And I do, you know, when you look at some of the culture wars that we fight now, it's hard not to code all of them as just a screaming cry for help of who am I? How can I connect? How can I be part of something larger than myself in a world where it's not immediately given to you the day that you're born? Congratulations, you're this religion. That's why you matter. That's why you connect. We've walked away from it, but I do think that people are hungry for something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that I still grapple with the big questions, you know, who am I? Why does that matter? What is this creation? What is this earth? What is this universe? You know, what's wrong with it? You know, are we participating in making it better? If so, how? A sense of goodness, a sense of morality, where does that come from? You know, and I know that atheists and theists will answer those questions. I just found the most coherent, cohesive set of answers in, frankly, you know, Hebrew Bible through Genesis 1 through Revelation 22. You know, and I found the most persuasive arguments, the most compelling cases made in some certain Christian theologians and academics that helped me understand what I was reading. I was hit by, say, the Sermon on the Mount, just in my own encounter with the Rabbi Jesus, right? So I was hit with that. Or James, you know, a letter written a little bit, you know, one of the smaller letters in the collection of the New Testament. And they spoke to me in a certain way. But here's the thing, man, like, if we have a sense of what is right and wrong, and a lot of people are really throwing temper tantrums out of a sense of, I think it comes from, this is wrong, and they're shaking their
justice.
Fists. Justice. Yeah, justice.
Yeah.
But what does that mean? And where does that come from? How would you define that? And are we supposed to have come out of the womb with your very understanding of that and your very articulation of that? Sometimes, you know, to your point, I think the excesses of some extremists would have us demonized for not knowing. I'll give you a specific example. I, in my ignorance, didn't know about Juneteenth. We weren't taught that when I was in grade school. So it was right around, it must have been 2020. I think I'd heard about it in years leading up to that, but it was 2020 when I felt compelled to really learn about it. And I was on a call with a number of people. And one person in particular said, "Oh, I'm out. I just can't do this."
Yeah.
Why? I'm sharing with you out of my vulnerability, my ignorance. What is the significance of Juneteenth? Help me understand. Oh, it's not my responsibility to help you understand. You should know. You should. This person was shooting on me.
Yeah.
You should know. So I was supposed to have, again, come out of the womb with all of this knowledge, the knowledge that that person wanted me to have. And the fact that I even asked the question was criminalized me, basically. And made me one of them, part of the problem. No, if we can't even ask the questions, man, we got a lot bigger problems.
Well, there's going to be a point, and it's not going to be any time within the next several years, but we're going to go back to that lockdown year, and there's just going to be writings and documentaries, and because the sociological experiment that we as a society went through, I think probably encompasses a lot of what we have talked about here in terms of fear, desire, meaning, hope, the reliance on some of the tenets that we have built our society on, up to and including science. When do we trust it? When do we not trust it? What is going on? Our own humanity to each other, as we saw with the post George Floyd stuff, of which Juneteenth went from something that in my world had only been studied by academics in African American studies to a noted holiday on ESPN, one of the more conservative right. broadcast networks in my entire history growing up. So there's a lot that's gone on there. You know, we're kind of at the end here, and for only 30 minutes, me and Corey Nathan have talked religion and politics, and we have refrained from killing each other. So if you would like something that is all of that, then I would highly recommend you go ahead and find Talking Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other, hosted by our guest, Corey Nathan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Justin, it was a pleasure, man. I hope it's not the last time. I'd love to hang out with you again.
Absolutely. And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, 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 written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio out here in Austin, Texas. If you'd like to email the show, it is theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Thank you to everybody who does that. I know we don't do a whole lot of email segments on here, but I do get back to everybody who sends something in. If you've got thoughts on the program, please go ahead and do it. theyoungamerican@gmail.com. If you'd like to find and share clips of the program, it is Justin R. Young on TikTok, Justin R. Young on Instagram, Politics, Politics, Politics on YouTube. And we're building this thing up. We're starting to get some random people. The algorithm, it hasn't fully smiled on us. But it's maybe a Mona Lisa smile. Maybe a little wink. It's recognizing that we're putting up stuff regularly. And you know that you are getting new viewers when they talk about how terrible you are. I love it. I love it. Please join them. Politics, Politics, Politics on YouTube. On Twitter, it is Justin R. Young. And you can share this podcast with your friends, family, and clergy. Something that obviously is in theme here with Corey Nathan on the program today. PX3podcast.com. If you would like to support us with a one-time donation, it is paypal.me/payjury. If you are on PayPal, Venmo is Justin-Young-20. Cash App is PX3Cash. And you can send me anything you'd like in the mail. P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. And I just paid my taxes. So, come on. I know you did too. But if you got a refund, Of course, you can always get our bonus content at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we missed on our free podcasting schedule. And our $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the show like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Sam, John, Niemeister, Edwin, and Vote Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Brian, Edison, Jeremy, A Dog Named Checkers, Sarah Jeannie, Matthew, Dr. G, Dustin, Brad, D Laser, Nick, Just Another Pilot, Middle Age Mike, Utah, Jimmy Montana, The Gen, Alo, D, Really? Andrew, Lisa, Fat Tony's PJs from New York, Devon, The CFP, Gloria, My Mom, Gray Zone, Peepaw, Jay, Neil, John, DP4, Bongo, Neil, His Nerdiness, Charles, Audrey, Stole, Adler, Spot, Darren, Idris, Arslanian, Berkeley, Steven, Nomadic, Terran, Molly's Delightful Demeanor, Adam, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, and Bluefront, and the Lenina. You want to join their ranks? One place to do it. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That's it for us today. On Friday's edition of the program, our old pal Evan Scrimshaw comes on. And I have a challenge for him. Here's what we're going to do, both of us. We're going to go back since 2000. So 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016, and 2020. And we are going to decide the demographic that decided the election. It's a little nerdy. It's a little cross tabs divey. But for this audience, for you guys, I think you're going to love it. Anybody who's like, oh, talking about meaning and religion and blah, 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 blah. Too heady. Give me the numbers. Oh, we got the numbers. We got the demos. We got the cross tabs for you. That's on Friday. I'll see the patrons on Thursday. Until next time, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying. Some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss all three.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.